Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances. And get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
But I was still think I was hallucinating. Then I heard again, can anybody hear us? If you hear us, tap or yell. So I kept yelling. And before I knew it, there were two Marine reservists, Jason Thomas and a Sergeant David Carnes, along with a civilian. They broke through the lines because after they the initial collapse of the buildings and they were starting search and rescue, they had to stop because unfortunately it was so dangerous. People were getting hurt. So they had to stop the first responders coming in. Mm-hmm. These guys broke through the lines. And they came in. Understand, we actually had both towers fall on us. We were in the epicenter, not far from the sphere. So both towers actually fell on us. These guys came into the middle and found us. I couldn't believe it. When they found me, I started yelling, hey, PAPD, officers down. They came and they were above us to my left. I didn't realize it was a small hole up there. So they were up there and it was shining the light. Now the light is shining on me. So, of course, I couldn't believe it. And the sergeant, we got found. He's like, oh, my God. You know, we're like, you know, we're yelling and we need help. I said, listen, we got guys down. We're hurt really bad. And they said, we got you. And I remember it saying, listen, man, don't leave us. I was in the Navy. We carried you guys. They're like, we're not leaving you, man. You know, I'm like, Semper Fi. And he's like, yeah, Semper Fi. We're not leaving you, brother.
Hey, crew, welcome back to Game of Crimes Part 2 with Will Jimeno, a Port Authority police officer who should have died on 9/11 in New York City, but by the grace of God, he's still here with us. If you listened to yesterday's episode, when we finished up, I'm amped up, I'm sweating, my legs are going up and down under the table here, and I don't want to waste any more time. Just want to welcome you back. Thank you for coming back and stand by because we're going to go through the rest of the story. So, Will, brother, thank you for coming back and continuing to tell your story. Where we left it yesterday is three of your colleagues, your best friends, have perished there in the collapse of one of the towers. You and your sergeant are both trapped under just tons and tons of concrete and rebar. You're really not seeing any hope until you pray. And all of a sudden, your mindset changed. And then what happened? What was next?
Well, after, like I talked about yesterday, having that vision of Jesus and getting to fight again, get back in a fight, went for many, many more hours. And around 8 o'clock that night is when I heard, United States Marine Corps, can everybody hear us? Now, being that I was in the Navy, being that I carried Marines, it was a very uplifting feeling to hear that. But at the same time, I'm thinking, if the Corps is here, we're at war. But I was still thinking I was hallucinating. Then I heard again, can anybody hear us? If you hear us, tap or yell. So I kept yelling. And before I knew it, there were two Marine reservists, Sergeant Thomas and Jason Thomas and a Sergeant David Carnes. They were both Marine reservists, along with a civilian. They broke through the lines because after they the initial collapse of the buildings and they were starting search and rescue, they had to stop because unfortunately it was so dangerous. People were getting hurt. So they had to stop the first responders coming in because it was unstable. Mm-hmm. These guys broke through the lines. And they came in. Understand, we actually had both towers fall on us. We were in the epicenter, not far from the sphere. So both towers actually fell on us. These guys came into the middle and found us. I couldn't believe it. When they found me, I started yelling, hey, PAPD, officers down. They came and they were above us to my left. I didn't realize it was a small hole up there. So they were up there and it was shining the light. Now the light is shining on me. So, of course, I couldn't believe it. I mean, and Sarge, we got found. He's like, oh, my God, you know, we're like, you know, we're yelling and we need help. I said, listen, we got guys down. We're hurt really bad. And they said, we got you. And I remember it saying, listen, man, don't leave us. I was in the Navy. We carried you guys. They're like, we're not leaving you, man. You know, I'm like, Semper Fi, you know, and he's like, yeah, Semper Fi. We're not leaving you, brother. So I finally said, well, I'm right here. And this was frustrating because it took them 5 minutes to actually about. I'd say almost 5 minutes to actually see me. Because mm-hmm. I'm waving my left hand. The light is on me. But remember, like I said, we were caked in concrete. Mm-hmm. It looked like part of the building. You couldn't tell. Now, all night long, like I said, I was very thirsty. I somehow, some way was able to muster enough spit and put it on my left palm. And when that changed my color from gray to my natural color skin, like brown, they said, "We got you." And that's when they sent civilian, what we call down the pile. That civilian bumped into NYPD Emergency Service Truck 1, which is their SWAT team. And those guys came up. It was such a bad situation where these guys could not come down. They had to burrow their way in from our right side. Scott Strauss, who led my rescue operation, and Patty McGee, and a civilian who came off the street, a guy who used to be a former paramedic, Chuck Sharika, they put their lives on the line. I mean, I remember Scott saying, "I couldn't get into that hole." He had to take his gun belt off. And he basically thought to himself, to his wife, "Pat, I'm sorry for dying, because this was really, really a bad situation." There was encroaching fires. They literally had to burrow their way through. The way Scott explains it to me was where they were coming was only like the size of underneath a fold-out chair. That's how they had to come. Now, two of them had to get chest to chest, and they're both bald. So all I could see when they got to me were two bald heads. What was interesting is when they got to me, I almost felt like I've been holding on now for 10 hours. Mm-hmm. I almost wanted to give myself to them. I was so exhausted, like, "All right, guys, just take me." And I started to hyperventilate to the point I thought I was giving myself a heart attack. And Scott said, "This is not over, bro. You got to keep focused. You got to keep fighting." It took a little while for me to calm myself down. They got a bag to me. I was able to calm down. And I remember the first time he touched me to start removing, I yelled because the pain was so immense. And I remember yelling and Scott stopping, like almost scared to touch me, because that's how much our bodies had bloated, like five times their size. So you touched us, we were in pain. And that's what I remember, just thinking to myself, "Well, you got to eat this pain, because this guy's not going to work if it keeps stopping." And my main thing was when they first got down there, I said, "Get my sergeant, get my sergeant." I just felt that I was younger. He was, in his screams that night were just, I can't, undescribable.
Horrific.
And they said, "No, we can't get you." See, at this point, I'm actually saying, "Get to my partner." I never said sergeant. I kept saying, "Get to my partner." So of course they see Dominic right next to me. They're thinking this guy is talking about his partner. They started working on me, and I kept yelling, "You got to get to my partner." And they're like, "No, we got to get you first." They never knew Sergeant McLaughlin was back there, because he just went silent. You know, Sergeant McLaughlin's just like, let them work on Will. And believe it or not, up to that point that night, it wasn't late into the night that we actually called ourselves by first name. I didn't know. I only knew him as Sergeant McLaughlin. I knew his first name was John, but I never called him that. He knew I was Jimeno, but he didn't know my first name. So that night we talked about our families. We got to know each other. And he's like, "You know, Jimeno, you know, what's your first name?" I said, "Will." I said, "What's yours, John?" But I never said anything. He just went quiet. And they were working on me. And I kept just telling them, get to my partner. And they're like, "No, we got to get you out first." Really suffering, because just to show you how the human body adapts to things, we ran out of air a long time ago. Actually, my Scott air pack still had air. I just wasn't using it. Our bodies became acclimated to that area. We were breathing smoke the whole time. Guys were choking to death. They couldn't get down there with equipment, so they were using my Scott air pack to get some whiffs of air. They were coughing. They were in so much pain and discomfort while they worked on me. It was very dark. And they were getting to me. They were starting to get stuff off, but it was a horror show, because here we are in the United States of America. You think you got the best equipment. There was about 700 people of a line leading to this hole. And when they would ask for equipment, it would get broken. They were doing everything by hand. At one point, they couldn't get my left leg out. And this is well into the rescue. And my rescue took 3 hours. Halfway through the rescue, they can't get this leg out, or toward the end. And I'm like, "Just cut my leg off." They had doctors above us standing by to cut our legs off, believe it or not. Cut my leg off. And the one Marine who was kind of a unique individual says, "Here, use this." He throws down a K-bar knife. For people that know what a K-bar knife is, it's what the Marine Corps issues their Marines. It's a big knife. Mm-hmm. And it has one side that has teeth on it. And he's like, "Here, use this. Cut his leg off with this." And I'm yelling, apparently, as Scott tells me, he's like, "Yeah, you're yelling, cut my leg off." Because I could see this hole. I'm thinking, I can live without a leg. But Sergeant McLaughlin, we got to get to him. And again, I just kept saying my partner. Just before they got me out is when Sergeant McLaughlin, out of the depths of hell, says, "How's it going?" Everybody freaks out in there. They freak out. They're like, "Who is that?" I said, "That's my partner. It's Sergeant McLaughlin." What was unique about that was, being that Sergeant McLaughlin was a former SWAT officer, these guys at ESU, they cross-trained with each other. They knew who Sergeant McLaughlin was. So not only did I feel, hey, these are my brothers in blue, they actually know each other. And several times, more than several times, they were ordered to leave us. And they basically said, no, we're not. And Paddy McGee, as Irish as you can be, born on St. Patrick's Day, New York City cop, BSU officer, he basically would say, we're not leaving. If they die, we die with them. Those are the kind of Americans that were there that day.
Yeah.
And finally, they were able to get my leg out. They put me on a Stokes basket. I said, Sarge, hold on. At this point, they telling Sergeant McLaughlin, we're no good to you. We've been here 3 hours. We're going to get a fresh crew in. They pulled me out of the hole. When I came out of the hole was the first time I cried, because I didn't cry when the collapse happened. I didn't cry when the guys died. I had no time for emotion. Mm-hmm. Emotion came when they pulled me out of the hole and I look up and I don't see the towers. It's nighttime. It's clear. And I said, where is everything? Because again, we didn't know the towers fell. And that's when a firefighter said to me, it's all gone, kid. And I felt like we failed. That's why I cried. I felt like there was still a lot of people down there. And I felt like we failed. Like as a cop, I failed. We failed. They sent me down the line, put me in the ambulance, took me to Bellevue Hospital. Second time I cried was when I get there. Now I'm thinking it's a little bit before midnight. And as a first responder, you hope that in a busy event, you're trying to do the right thing. If you're hurt, maybe a doctor will peek at you real quick. And all these doctors and nurses are standing around. And they get me off the ambulance. I'm like, where is everybody? And they're like, you're it. How could that be? How could it be it's almost midnight or nighttime? Because I don't even know what time it is. And you're telling me, like, I'm it. There's no other survivors. And they whisked me in a room. All I remember was, like, bees all around me. The only thing that caught my attention was they put the catheter in. That woke me up. Yep. And then I passed out. They had to cut my leg completely open. It blew up from senior officers told me they had to leave the room. They'd never seen anything like it because we were so bloated. They had to cut my leg from my upper left thigh all the way to my lower left ankle, and it just blew up. A white wall went red. They had to start literally extracting pieces of muscle out of my body that were dead and dying. And then my sergeant came out the next morning at 7. We didn't know till the following year we went back. We were still in wheelchairs to thank the NYPD, ESU Truck 1, that they told us, do you guys know you're the only two guys to survive from underneath the World Trade Center? There was 18 of us that survived. Me and my sergeant are the only two from under the rubble. 13 were in a stairwell. A fellow officer, Dave Lim, one of our canine guys, along with a fire crew that was friends, actually, from Goshen, New York, where Sergeant McLaughlin lived, was his friend, Jay Jonas, and his crew, and a civilian, Port Authority civilian, who unfortunately, I think she passed like 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then a couple other people, when one of the first tower fell, the South Tower fell, I think two gentlemen survived that. And then the last person pulled out was Mrs. Guzman, who was a Port Authority employee. They found her topside at noon the next day. She was literally in her stairwell stuck, took some injuries to her leg. So there's only 18 of us that survived after both towers fell and everything was said and done. You know, thank goodness it's the largest rescue operation before the towers fell. I think they evacuated 25,000 people. So that is some light in that day. And the 18 of us are a testament that you will not kill off America. You will not kill off good human beings. We're here today as 18 people that survived the World Trade Center to show people that in the midst of evil, they're still good. They're still light. And I like to think that me particularly when I speak, that's what I bring to the table, is to show people out of a horrific event, there were good people and there were good outcomes. As few as they were, there's always still hope. And that's what I want people to understand, that on 9/11, they thought they were going to bring us to our knees, which they did. But we got up on our knees the moment that everybody started responding and helping each other. And not only the people in uniform. I want to be very clear about that. I'm very proud as a first responder. We lost a lot of first responders, but there was a lot of civilians, just like your regular mom and dad, husband, wife, children who turned around and actually put their lives on the line as well. So we came together as Americans, as human beings, to show that there's more good in this world than bad.
Absolutely. Right on, brother. Now, when they cut your leg open, you actually flatlined, didn't you?
Yes. Actually, that evening I flatlined twice. That was told to me probably months later. I mean, we were so banged up. I mean, I think about 11 surgeries. Sergeant McLaughlin has been through, I think it's well over 50 surgeries. Today, he still has open wounds. People ask us, like, when is 9/11 over for you? And I've always said the day 9/11 and we're done with is the day they bury us.
Yeah.
Something like, just like any soldier, anybody who's been in a situation, that's something that you have to learn to live with. It's difficult for some people to live with it, and they unfortunately take their lives. So it's something that is I hope to be an example of someone who's been through a tragedy, is able to pick up the pieces, move forward, and try to live a fruitful life.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about somebody who's been given a second chance, all these survivors are, and all the heroes that were out there. It's just, it's beyond human comprehension the way people will react until they have to react. And thank God they were there for you. I mean, I know you suffered burns, you had to go through skin grafts. Yes. What about your lungs?
So that's an interesting thing. I'm knocking on wood right now. So particularly me, they put a tube down my throat when I was at Bellevue Hospital. And for a couple of days, they literally were sucking out the soot that was in my lungs. I could actually see rocks coming out. You can hear them coming out. The doctor had asked my wife, Allison, does he smoke? And I've never been a smoker. And she said, no, why? And he said, because his lungs look like he's been smoking for 30 years. Believe it or not, my lungs cleared out. I've yet to have any respiratory issues. I'm very blessed. My sergeant does have respiratory issues. Scott Strauss had respiratory issues. Patty McGee, the two NYPD officers. I don't know why I'm at that point. I had strong lungs. My father said, oh, well, you weren't down there long enough to get affected. I'm like, Dad, that's pretty bad. We were literally sucking in smoke. How we didn't die from the smoke inhalation, mm-hmm. I think a lot had to do with the hole that was open was allowing air to flow through. But for any reason, I'm still going strong. You know, I'm 57. I keep up with my health as best as I could. I can always do better. But yeah, but a lot of our, as we know, we've lost more first responders now to 9/11 illness than we lost on that day. So it's something serious, and it's a lot of weird cancers. I mean, we've lost about 8 to 10 Port Authority police officers. John Cortazzo, my good friend from K-9, was the first one. He developed some really weird cancer that was, you know, contributed from the World Trade Center. So fortunately, again, 9/11 has its tentacles out there. And I've always said, I'm going on 24 years here. I tell my kids, of course, if I pass tomorrow from an illness or anything, yes, of course, you're going to be sad. You're going to cry for me. But also understand that I've had 24 years that my partners who have died did not have.
Right.
Been able to see my girls grow up. I've been able to live a fruitful life, and I continue to do that. I hope I continue to do it for a long, long time, as well as my fellow first responders. But the reality is that we don't know what's going to happen. But up to today, my lungs are strong. I still have my physical injuries. I have drop foot because my nerves were severed in my leg. There's days I don't function correctly because of my injuries, but I go back to what my mom told me, don't use that as a crutch. And I look at my sergeant. He's got double the injuries. He lost pretty much his buttocks. He has a hard time walking. He has respiratory issues, and he never complains. He just moves forward. So I always say, when you think you got it bad, look around. You're going to see that other people have it worse.
Victims who became heroes. Just briefly, how long were you in the hospital, and then how long were you in rehab?
I was at Bellevue Hospital for about a month and a half, close to 2 months. Then I went to rehab center. I was there for about a month and a half. And then home, it was years of rehab to be able to walk, be able to be independent, and learn to be able to deal with these wounds. So it took years.
And we want to talk about the aftermath here just a little bit, but also they kept you on with the police department until 2004. Is that right?
Yeah, I was still with the police department. Unfortunately, I couldn't do much. And it was heartbreaking for me because when it was time, I mean, my lawyers and my doctors, they said, you're done as a cop. You have to retire. Your injuries are something you can't go back and do or be fulfilling. Was mm-hmm. So I had to put in my papers, and it was tough. And the funny thing is, you know, sometimes as police officers, firefighters, when you're injured, sometimes you do have that opportunity to go and live a good life with a decent pension. I didn't have much of a decent pension, but I knew I had to retire. And I asked the disability doctor, I said, can you keep me on one more year? He's like, no, you're done. And he goes, you're the first person to ever ask for me for that. He's like, most people want to take their pension and go out. So, well, I never did this for the money, and I don't have much of a pension to retire on. I just didn't want to leave, but I had to. Unfortunately, it was just my time. And that's what I tell any responder out there. Sometimes your dreams as being a first responder, whatever job it is you have, sometimes it gets cut short, and you're going to have to the pieces, and that's hard. And that's what happened to me. I had to rebuild my life, and it was a difficult road. But I retired in 2004, and then I started a new journey, and that new journey encompassed trying to find my sunrise, my happiness, and dealing with a lot of PTSD. And it was a challenge not only for myself, but my family, because people don't realize that when you're suffering, your family suffers. So that started a new journey.
the police department, there's not a medical pension that you go out on where you get a percentage of what you're making?
I did get it, but it wasn't as large because they go on what your yearly salary is. So it wasn't something that I could say, ooh, look at me. No, mm-hmm. I got a minimal amount. And then I, you know, was very fortunate enough to be able to do what I needed to do to support my family and everything like that. But the bigger challenge was the what was coming, which was the nightmare of PTSD.
And that did that start before you got home, or did home bring on that anxiety?
I think my wife will tell you. She said, "The moment you got home, you were different." I never knew that. It took me a long time to even realize I was suffering from that. My wife knew right off the bat that I was different. And PTSD comes in different variations, you know, anger, anxiety, depression. The list goes on. And for me, it was anger. I was angry. I was angry what happened to our country. I was angry what happened to our department, to my partners, to me, to my family. And I was very short fused. I was very short fused. But I was busy too, because I was still going to therapy. I was very busy. It really happened more when I was home and everything was quiet. And that's what I want to tell anybody, especially anybody who's been in our service, whether it be military, first responders, or you've just had a tragedy in your life. Understand that when you're home alone and quiet is when the emotions come out. When you're busy, if you're busy and you're doing physical stuff, you're busy, your mind's occupied. The problem is, and I speak a lot to our GWAP vets that fought in the war against terrorism, that it's when you get home and there's not that support. There's nobody saying, hey, you know, you're a hero, which I don't feel I am. I did my job. When you're getting all the attention, when people are looking after you, but when you're home, the demons come in. Mm-hmm. And those demons come in various avenues. Like I said, for me, it was anger. I was angry. I was nasty. I was being nasty to my family. And this went on for a while. And I remember what really was the tipping point for me was one night I was there. Now, mind you, my daughter Olivia was born November 26, 2001, on my birthday. They told me if I could get myself in a wheelchair, I could be there for the birth of my daughter. And I was. Here I am, home, survived the World Trade Center, 220 stories falling, survived the horrific events, the worst attack in U.S. history. Now I'm home with my beautiful wife, a four-year-old little girl, in my new house with a new baby. And I was being just terrible. I was not who Will Jimeno was. I was somebody else. I was scaring people. I was yelling at people. I was nasty. And I remember the tipping point was one night. At this point, this is time has passed. I'm able to drive at this point because my left leg was the one injured. But, you know, I'm still using walkers and stuff like that. I was asking for where the remote was. I didn't know where the remote was. And I demanded the remote. And my wife wasn't moving fast enough to find it. I remember picking up a shoe and I was going to, like, literally throw it at her head. And I caught myself, like, whoa, what are you doing? This is not who you are. You've never lifted your hand to a woman. And I remember just dropping a shoe, getting in my truck, and I drove up to the country. I'm a big outdoorsman, big bow hunter. And I drove up to where I usually bow hunted on public land, and I sat there in this parking lot looking into a field. And I said to myself, there's something wrong with you. I don't know what it is. And I was scared. I was lonely. I didn't know. But what I did think about that night was, I thought about how people who were brought up in a very harsh environment, whether it be you're raised by an alcoholic, an abusive parent, an addicted parent, sometimes because of those parents and what they're going through, they teach, they instill that in their child and they grew up to be something. You know, we see that all the time. And I thought, if I allow myself to not be a good husband, a good father, these cowards, terrorists, through me, now will affect another generation of Americans. Maybe my daughters will grow up screwed up. Maybe I'll end up in a divorce because my wife hates me. And I said at that point, I got to do what I have to do. And I've always said this to people. Macho is, I was specifically talking to men. Macho is doing what you have to do when you have to do it. Irrelevant what task is. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I made a decision. I'm going to go seek help. Now, mind you, I had been talking to the police psychologist, but I just was going through a routine because now they're talking to me and I don't know what to say. Because I don't know what to feel. Mm-hmm. But I went home and I went upstairs to my daughter's room, Bianca. And I said, I'm sorry I yelled. I said, does daddy yell a lot? She goes, yeah, daddy, sometimes you scare us. And I said, at that point, that's it. So I started that going from therapist to therapist. It took me several therapists till I found one therapist who, Debbie Mandel, God bless her. She actually passed from 9/11 illness because she would spend so much time down at the Trade Center talking to people. But I went to her and really, I felt like a hamster on a wheel. I felt like this was just a waste of time till the day she said to me, you understand that what you're living with, you have to figure a way out to let that negative energy out. For me, again, it was anger. I could go for a walk. I could hit a punching bag. I would need it to let out some physical bad energy. But she said, Will, you have to learn how to live with this. And I realized that if I could learn to live with this, when I can see the symptoms of me, the PTSD taking over, and me be able to stop it and come to terms with this, it's something that I have to do, because that way I can live a fulfilling life for myself, but more importantly, for my family. And this is what I tell everybody. If you've been a drug addict, an alcoholic, you've been abused, you don't just get rid of these things. They're mm-hmm. with you for life. That darkness is with you for life. You have to seek your sunrise by learning to live with it, because you never get rid of it. It's just something that you have to learn to live with. And that's something that I do. And does it raise its ugly head from time to time? Yes. I'm fortunate it hasn't in a long time. And my wife also learned to go to therapy with me and signal like, hey, you're getting upset. Don't let this get to you. Because then I kind of fly off the handle. And again, I feel, I don't know if anger is better. Depression, anxiety, I don't know how that affects people, nor do I want to. But what I do tell people is that I found my own roadmap. And, you know, I started doing speaking engagements, and mm-hmm. I didn't want to do speaking engagements. It was my next door neighbor in 2003 who said, can you come talk to our children in our sixth and seventh grade schools? I'm like, what am I going to talk to them about? Just your survival, your bravery. I'm like, and I said, okay. So I put my uniform on. I wasn't even walking good. I went there, and I remember I had just recently spoken to Antonio Rodriguez's wife. She had told me that they were honoring him in Portugal with a statue.
Wow.
That his children didn't want to get on a plane because they were scared.
Mm-hmm.
The effect these terrorists had on our country. They were scaring people to fly. And Antonio's wife, Christina, said to the children, we're going to get on that plane. We're going to honor your father. Because if we falter to fear, they win.
Yep.
So what I told you now, I told to the kids. And I realized that, you know what? We can't live in fear. We have to go forward. We have to live a fulfilling life. And from that, I guess somebody else told, hey, Will came to the school and went from school to high school to military groups to police departments. And it's grown to where I get called. And I don't even advertise. It's always just word of mouth, depending what I'm doing, who the crowd is. But it ended up in Fairleigh Dickinson University, where I was asked to speak to a group called Latino Promise, a lot of Hispanic students, great crew of people. But this was 2007, 2008. The war in Fallujah was raging. So mm-hmm. I would always ask, hey, who are our military persons? And you know, without asking somebody who's been seen action, because I wanted to reach out to those people who have been through some tragedy. Of course, I appreciate everybody's service, but it's those very few people who actually have been injured, have seen their comrades die, their brothers and sisters die in combat. So I would ask, who was in theater? And I would see the Marines or the Navy guys or Army guys or Air Force guys, they kind of wink or whatever. But this one particular Marine at the end of my speech came on down and said, hey, you know, what you said really meant a lot about faith, hope, and love. I felt about the PTSD, my struggles with PTSD. So he comes back the following year. I go back to that same university. At the end of that speech, he gets up after the Q&A and says, hey, I'd like everybody to pay attention to Will. It helped me save my life. And he shared with us that, you know, he was thinking of doing something bad. And it blew me away. Like that me sharing my story and where I'm at helped him. And that mm-hmm. helped me, because every time my PTSD, I kept thinking about him. I kept thinking about, hey, I shared something. I preached something. I got to not only preach it, I got to live it. Because it's easy to preach. And sometimes we don't follow our own preaching. And I remember him walking up and just blew me away. And he said, you know, you got to write a book. You got to help because we're losing so many vets to suicide. And I tried for several years. And the people, because they ended up making a movie about us called World Trade Center by Oliver Stone in 2007. And the people I would talk to in Hollywood or whatever say, hey, man, we love you, but they made a movie about you. And I said, it's not about the movie. It's not about the event. It's the after part, which many of us deal with once we come home from our service, whether it be military, law enforcement, drug, DEA, some of us have been through some really bad stuff. And now that support group, that group we're around, they're no longer there. It's just us dealing right. with our memories, our demons. But finally, in the 20th anniversary, I was able to write the book that you see over my shoulder here, Sunrise Through the Darkness. which I wrote with my friend, Dr. Michael Motes, who worked in Colorado Springs with the military.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
And what I told Michael is I want to share what I have to say. And then what he did was, which I appreciated, which I could have used back in the day, was he put in exercises in the book that if you're someone who doesn't want to talk to a therapist yet, you can do these exercises, talk about it, think about it. So it gives you one more day, one more week, one more month than the alternative, which is suicide. And that's what I want. I want to reach people here today that if you are in a bad place, as I call it, the darkness, you need to fight to get to your sunrise. And the blueprint's going to be different. So people will say, Will, what did you do? Well, understand what I did was I put my family in the forefront that I want to fight for them, not for me. Because unfortunately, I tried to end my life twice. And every time I did that, I said to myself, you're cheating them. And I'm grateful because I've been able to live such a good life and see my girls grow up and be there and inspire people and be there for my wife and see her smile. And we all deserve that. I want to make that very clear. Don't you ever think you don't deserve to live, because I had much survivor's guilt. And there was those times that pushed me to the edge of why am I alive? Why is not Dominic, Antonio, Chris, Stewart, Bruce Reynolds, the rest of the 37, altogether the 37 officers we lost, which was the most in law enforcement history in one day. But I realized that we only have so much time on this earth. And what I do is I live every day the best I can. And that's the way I honor those that lost their life. By being able to have been there for my daughter's communion, confirmations, birthday parties, you know, sweet scenes, graduation. I'm proud that both my girls graduated from Auburn University. Got to see that. They're the first two in my family to receive four-year degrees. I only have an associate's. So there's so much to live in life that you deserve. And if you lost somebody, you know, understand no matter how you lost somebody, live for them. If you're not going to live for yourself, live for them because they would want the best for you. And that's what I realized that. I know my fellow teammates, if I was on the other end and I didn't make it, I would want happiness for them. And that's what I want for everybody. So if you're someone who's struggling, look up the book Sunrise Through the Darkness by Will Jimeno on Amazon. And it's been helpful for people. I've had people to reach back out to us to tell us that it's helped them. And I'll be honest with you, it's helped other people than first responders, military. And I got an email from a doctor who said, you know, you've helped three of my patients. And I was like, well, what kind of patients are they? And it was a doctor who had women with postpartum. And I'm like, that blew my mind. Because see, and this is something I want everybody to understand. The events we go through, the tragedy we go through, they're not competitive. I want you to understand this. People will walk up to me, Will, I can't think of anything worse than 220 stories hitting you. Sure you can. You lost a loved one. You found out you got cancer. You lost a child. Mm-hmm. At that moment, you might as well have 220 stories hitting you. It's what we do with ourselves. And understand this. What I'm saying is easier said than done. Because through my fight through PTSD, it was horrible. It was a struggle. But if I did it, which I am no different or any more special than any of you listening to this podcast, you can do it. So whatever your goal is to reach your sunrise, which is your happiness, keep going forward. Keep fighting. Doesn't matter how long it does take. But while you're here doing it, you're moving forward because the alternative is no good. You know, suicide or living in a dark place the rest of your life is not what you deserve. Because every person that's listening to this podcast, you're an important person. You're important to this world. You're important to your family. And you know what? Every time someone jumped out of those buildings, it's like a pebble. You don't really get that ripple effect. You don't understand how many lives you touch. Every person that was jumping from that building on 9/11, each of those that lost their lives, they touched so many people. So understand that your life is important and you're important and there's nothing you can't overcome. And there's people out there that are willing to help you. That's what I found out. I was scared at first. I was lonely. I didn't think anybody was really going to help me, but there were. There were people out there, starting with my family. And if you're not fortunate enough to have an uplifting family, go to your church, go to your YMCA. I guarantee you there's going to be people there that are going to listen and they're going to want to help you.
couple things. One that stuck out to me in your book, you made a statement in there, no single path to healing, that everybody's different. So even though what worked for you, there's other paths that people could take that might work for them. It's not one single solution that gets rid of PTSD or helps you deal with PTSD.
Everybody has to go on their own journey. And again, when you start your journey, it's going to be scary. It's going to be tough. You're going to feel alone, but you're not alone. And, you know, again, where does courage come from? It comes from overcoming your fears. So make a decision to want to get better, to want to be able to live with your demons and control them and suppress them. And you can do it.
And for our listeners, we're not finished yet, but you've heard me talk about this on other episodes. There is a national crisis hotline here in the United States. All you have to do is dial 988. That's it, 988. You can call, you can text, you can chat with them. That they're open 24/7, 365. They speak English and Spanish. If they're not the ones that can help you on the line right then, they will put you in touch with somebody. And just like Will here, excuse me, Will here is the shining example of how you come back from a tragedy that he should have died from. There's absolutely no reason for him to be alive today except through the grace of God. Same holds true for you. If you're having problems, if you're having anxiety, if you're having thoughts of suicide, call 988. There are people out there waiting to help you. Just interviewed the episode from last week that's on before your episode was Scott Payne, who's retired FBI, who's just a stud of a man, infiltrated some of the worst gangs and organizations in the throughout the United States. And he had to go through a variety of counselors before he found one that clicked for him. And I think reading your book, it was the same for you. And he put it the best way of anybody I've heard so far. He said, have you ever had food poisoning? Mm-hmm. We all have. Did you stop eating? No, you got over it and you moved on. So if you don't get along with the counselor, move on to the next counselor till you find somebody just like you do with Debbie who clicks for you, who gets you in a place where you are able to heal. Now, there's a couple things I like about the book. One is you talked about how the Mike, the psychologist, clinical psychologist, there's thought sections at the end of each chapter. Yes. There's questions that you can answer. So if you're having issues with this, a fantastic book. But I think this surprised me more than anything. I like to talk about our unsung heroes because that's our families. And they suffer. Oh, man, they probably suffer more than we do.
Yeah.
And I always try to give them credit. But in your book, I came across a chapter towards the end that's titled A Spouse's Point of View. And that's from your wife, Allison. I've never seen another book like that.
Let me tell you, that was something because Allison doesn't really, she's very quiet. She's private. Mike had to convince her that by her chapter, you're going to be addressing the families of people who are dealing and at the forefront of PTSD. And I actually learned a lot from writing the book. I didn't know there was something called secondary PTSD. And that's what we give our families. Because if you're the person that, let's say like me, I'm the focal point because of what happened, everybody's paying attention to me. And I'm, again, my PTSD, I was being mean, nasty. I was someone embarrassed to think of who that person was. But my family suffered. My children suffer. My parents are suffering, especially my wife. And I'll be honest with you, she's an angel. What she put up with and still here today with me, and thank goodness we're happy, that chapter is a very impactful one because remember, not only do you put on the uniform, the shield, or the service you're doing, your family puts it on too without asking or knowing. They are part of the job that you do. And it's very important. That chapter's one of the things I'm very proud of because that has been able to help a lot of people, especially the family members. So just remember, if you're suffering from something, it's not only affecting you, it's affecting your loved ones as well.
Yeah. Are you continuing to tell your story today?
Yes. I just came back from a speaking engagement this past week in Columbia, Missouri, where they had a 9/11 stair climb, and which makes me really proud that people are not forgetting you. We have the slogan there. And what I find is that people are not forgetting. I would love to see every state implement a 9/11 curriculum to the younger children so they understand, just like I did, what Pearl Harbor was. They should understand what 9/11 is. But I am blessed to be asked to speak a lot. And I'm blessed to be able to, through my speaking engagements, not only inspire people, but also help people that are in a bad spot. I cannot tell you, I never get out of a speaking engagement without people coming up and talking to me and sharing some of what they're going through and just hearing them say, you know, you've given me hope for me. And again, I think it's because they realize I am no different than them. I was a kid that wanted to be a cop, and a cop that try to do the right thing, and a cop that ended up in a bad situation, and there were good people to come in and get me. So that's what I try to inspire people, is to give them strength and hope. And I want people to understand that there's nothing you can't accomplish. And remember this, this is something I tell the kids. We don't have a lot of time. We always say life is short, but think of it this way. There's 365 days in the year. Let's say you're lucky to live till 90, which most of us don't. Take 365 and multiply it by 90. See how many days that gives you on Earth. Part of that time, when we're born, we're in diapers. Sometimes when if we're lucky enough to reach 90, you might be in diapers again. There's not that many days here. Yep. Do the math. 365 times 90. And now subtract how many days you've been on this Earth. That doesn't leave us with a lot of time. So make the most out of life. Try to be a positive impact. Try to absorb all the good stuff. And fight hard to overcome the bad stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's several quotes that I put into my notes here, and they're a little bit long, but I think they're certainly worth sharing with everybody. And folks, highly encourage you to get this book, especially if you or you know someone that's suffering from PTSD or anxiety or stress, overstress, whatever it might be. This is a great book for you to read, just to give you some ideas. But there's one that's it's so important to remember that people from all ages, genders, ages, economics and nationalities were affected on that day, talking about 9/11. They were killed, injured, traumatized, showed courage, were compassionate, cried together, helped one another, clung to one another, and showed the power of shared humanity in the face of evil, destruction, and intense cruelty. I mean, that just sums 9/11 up in a book there. And the reason I brought that out is it brought people together to do uncommon acts of valor and heroism. You're saying you're not a hero, you're doing your job. A hero doesn't know that they're a hero. They'll never tell you they're a hero. One of the others is the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men and women to do nothing, by Edmund Burke. When my partner and I, when we speak, if it's a law enforcement audience, depending on the length of the presentation, we'll have an intermission. And that's the screen that's on there to recognize them, because just like you, you're not one of those men or women that chose to do nothing. You actually stepped up to the plate and served your country twice. And one more, whatever your World Trade Center is, a crash, a rape, war, overwhelming bills, health issues, loss, whatever it is, you can make it through. It might be messy, but keep clawing, keep fighting for your life. Be careful with being distracted by things outside of your power. For example, other successes, judgment from others, things that are outside of your control. And refocus on what you can affect today. And I think that might be the most important message that I got out of your book. Because it doesn't matter where you are. There are people that are jealous. There's haters out there.
Yeah.
And because you're moving forward and you're continuing to live your life and you're able to deal with the circumstances, people are jealous of that.
Yeah.
Man, if you can just avoid that.
And with social media, people get tangled up in that stuff. And that's make-believe, guys. I tell people, just take a month to focus on you and nothing else, and you'll be amazed how much happier you are and how much productive you can be.
Yeah. So
remember, again, you're important.
This is I don't want to let you go here, man. You are a beacon of hope, whether you want to admit it or not, to so many people that are just struggling with whatever issues they have in their life. I saw where you eventually were awarded the Medal of Honor by the Port Authority Police Department. That's a pretty big deal. The movie by Oliver Stone, World Trade Center. Now, how much of that do you think is true?
Pretty much all of it. We were part of the film. We were very fortunate. The film would have never come around without Deborah Hill. God rest her soul. She was a female producer, a big groundbreaker in the 70s and the 80s in Hollywood when women really didn't have a lot of say. She did. She actually produced all the Halloween movies, Escape from New York with Kurt Russell and Escape from L.A. She actually saw our story in an article in the Philadelphia paper, and she's the one that started the ball rolling, along with Stacey Sher and Michael Schanberg, and then they brought in Oliver and all the actors. So I was on set a lot. What I can say to this, and if you're a law enforcement person or first responder, you'll understand this. I don't really care what the audience in general thought of the movie. What I felt was important was when my senior cops saw first time in a private screening, and when they came out, they gave me the thumbs up, like, that was good. You did good. And that's all that meant to me. Because the families of those lost understood that their loved ones will live forever in this film. I cannot tell you how many people use this film throughout the world to educate people about 9/11 and the good of that day. And the one good thing about, like you said, September 12th, there was no politics. There was no pointing fingers. There was people just caring about each other. And that's what we brought out in this film. We showed the good of that day. Because remember, if you allow a tragedy to just be a tragedy, then it's just that. But out of a tragedy, if you can find light, it's not a tragedy. You learn something. And on 9/11, we learned we should treat each other better. And that anytime there's something bad happens, like we said, what Edmund Burke says, there will be good men and women who step up to the plate to come and help. Mm-hmm. So the movie was done correctly. Oliver was very thoughtful. Oliver was very honest. They had a couple things there they had to do for movie stuff, but overall it was accurate. And we're blessed to have had such a great crew of people, from Deborah all the way to the last actor, to the last cameraman, sound person, to be part of this project, because we're really proud of it.
Excellent. That's encouraging to hear. I remember reading in your book also that one of the doctors told you that during that night, that immediate time around 9/11, that they actually had a major reduction. Nobody coming in for shootings and stabbings, none of the victims.
Well, I spent a lot of time in ICU, both me and my sergeant. And for the first 2 weeks, we didn't have a single person come in from a gunshot, stabbing, mugging, nothing.
Wow.
Which was leaving them flabbergasted, because Bellevue Hospital is one of the busiest hospitals in New York City, one of the best hospitals. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, before the first stabbing victim came in, for 2 weeks in New York City, they didn't have anybody coming into ICU with any type of crime issues, which is a blessing. And again, we are human beings, especially as Americans, we have a short attention span. But for 2 weeks, people were kind to each other that they could see in the ICU, which is astronomically.
It's unbelievable. Absolutely. We saw such patriotism. I had mentioned earlier, we had just moved to D.C. And I remember going to work after 9/11, and everybody had little American flags taped to their antennas on the cars. And the bridges, when you go underneath the bridge, you'd always see American flags hanging off those. Just very patriotic time. It's just a shame that our memories here in the United States are 2 weeks long.
Well, I still believe, and I tell people this, there's more patriotism than they want to show, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I still believe in America. I believe in the American people. I believe in good people. We're shown that every single time from, and it's been shown since the Boston bombing to the natural disasters where you had the redneck or Cajun Navy go out there. People who you would think otherwise might not want to help people because of their skin color, they don't care. People come together, and that's what I try to strive to do. Don't get duped by what the media shows you, what social media shows you. When something bad happens, people step up, and they come from every walk of life, color of skin, creed, religion, political views. They're there to help you.
Absolutely. Now, I got to ask you about one more thing here before we start finishing this off. You were on TV in 2008, weren't you?
Yes. Yeah.
I was shocked when I read that. Tell us about that a little bit.
I was on a show called Deal No Deal with Howie Mandel. how that came about was the New York City Police Department has a movie department unit, and they were looking supposedly for a hero. And Patty McGee, who was one of the two NYPD officers that saved my life, reached out to me and said, hey, they're looking for a hero. And they all thought, hey, Will would be perfect for this. And what was funny was, at the time, there was a gentleman who actually did a heroic thing. I was on a subway. Somebody was on a subway. And actually, this gentleman, I believe, jumped over someone who fell on the track, and the train kind of went over them, and he saved them. So they had selected him, and they had talked to me, and they said, hey, we're going to pass you over because we're going to go with this gentleman. I said, that's fine. That's great. Mm-hmm. And I forgot about it. And I think it was that October 2007, they called me and said, hey, we'd like you to come out to LA to be on this show. And it's funny because me and wife love Deal No Deal. We'd always watch it. So it came about. I got on the show. I had a great time on the show. Pretty good because I wasn't greedy. I was on the show with Howie Mandel, and I was proud to be able to talk about, surviving 9/11. But more importantly, I always talk about is the 37th. You know, this is our memorial patch, the Port Authority Police of New York and New Jersey, 37, the most law enforcement officers lost in one day in U.S. history, followed by our brothers and sister, 23 at the NYPD, 343 firefighters, and the countless civilians, not only at the World Trade Center, but at the Pentagon and on Flight 93. So what I tell people is, please never forget all of 9/11, but let us not forget all of our American history. because again, tragedies are not competitive. So the World Trade Center has its place. And yes, is this the worst attack in U.S. history? But I don't want to forget the Boston bombing, any terrorist attack, the wars we've been in. We need to remember everything. So never forget means never forget all of our American history. That's the way we honor those that died, bled, and suffered. You know, Iwo Jima, you know, to Hamburger Hill. We want to not forget these people and teach our future generations what makes America great. And that is the love and sacrifice that our fellow Americans give. And they come from all walks of life.
Absolutely. And just here towards the end, also, we talked about this on a few episodes back with Brian Sizemore, whose son was an Atlanta police officer that committed suicide with only four months on the job. Again, ladies and gentlemen, Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is 988. If you need help, call it. I looked up some statistics for that interview about our military and first responders. And what I found out is one of the occupations that has a high suicide rate also is our doctors. And my oldest son is an orthopedic surgeon in Atlanta. So it kind of gives me a little pause there to think about. But what I found out, especially in the first responder field in law enforcement, is that on an average between 2016 and 2022, an average of 184 police officers committed suicide each year. Now that's an average. So you have your highs and your lows, which is one is way too many, but I looked at, some of the demographics that go along with that. And it's primarily white guys, that the amount of women that commit suicide is very low, but the average years of service is 16 and a half years. The age range, there's no specific range. It's between 25 and 59. And the highest state for suicides in first responders is California with 109, New York second with 103, New Jersey third with 60, then Texas and Florida come in next. I thought, well, what are some of these reasons? Why? I was a cop for 38 years and I can honestly say suicide never entered my mind. I used to joke around, if you ever find me dead and they rule it suicide, tell them to reinvestigate because it's a homicide. I couldn't do that to myself. Depends on the circumstances. Just like I know you never thought about committing suicide, but that's what PTSD does to you, right?
Well, yeah, it puts you in a very dark place and it's very hard to describe. Because, you know, again, you would think I would never do that to myself, and I understand where people, when people don't, or I've been close to the edge, it's just a very bad place and it's, you're not thinking right. That's all I can say. You're not thinking right. It's very hard to tell someone who's thinking right, oh, this is how you feel when you're not thinking right. Cause they don't know. And hopefully you're not there. And if you're getting close to that, like I said, reach out, get help because there are people out there to help you.
Yeah. The three leading reasons I found for suicide or considering suicide is hopelessness due to shame. I think it's a lot of peer pressure right there. Lack of support, whether it's externally or self-imposed, because like you talked about, you didn't know where to turn to start with. Yeah. And the people you were talking to didn't really seem like you were getting any benefit out of it. And the third is fear of potential consequences with their careers, such as getting your licenses to do your job, your security clearances, loss of employment, and that kind of thing. Why am I mentioning all this is because we need to bring more attention to suicide. Did you know that suicides in law enforcement is the major cause of death of police officers? It's not shootings. It's not car accidents. It's not even dying from cancer because of 9/11. It's because of suicide. Man, I can't drive that message home. I'm starting to get excited here and knock my camera over if I'm not careful.
And you can't. That's what I tell people. Understand that we're going to lose people. I speak every year. I'm blessed to speak for a GWAT group that comes out of Wisconsin on a flight. And unfortunately, last year, even after speaking, we had one person take their life. And I wish I could say, hey, what I said should have changed his mind, but it doesn't. But what we can do is keep plugging away, keep hammering away, keep talking to people, keep reminding people.
Right.
Because I believe we save more people by uplifting and supporting each other than we do by not. So never get tired of saying the whole speech about you need help, there's someone there, because you never know when you're going to be able to turn that person who's in a bad place around.
Absolutely. Again, that hotline is 988, everybody, 988. So you've given us a lot to think about there. I know you've got great advice, and you're not doing it from a clinical standpoint. You're doing it from, this is what I went through.
Yeah, and that's what I tell people. I'm not a clinician. I'm not a psychologist. All I'm telling you is just like I believe what it started with the American Indian, just telling stories, passing down, inspiring people. I'm just trying to tell you that if I'm here and I'm no different than you, you can do it too. That's all. And I just want people to live a good life.
You're truly an inspiration, Will. And you know, certainly you're being very humble about it. Thank you for sharing your story. Your situation is a perfect example of how somebody could have let their circumstances determine their future. And there were times when you were probably going to do that, but you hung in there. You fought the hard fight, continuing on I won't say a daily basis, but brother, you're in our prayers. We wish the best for you and your family, your daughters.
Thanks.
There should be some grandbabies coming along not too far down the road, right?
We'll see.
Yeah. I got this right out of your book. And this would be my final thought is John 15:13. Now the greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Man, that just wraps it all up there. Just to the heroes that suffered that day, law enforcement, first responders, or just victims. God bless you and your families. If we want to find out more about Will Jimeno, I found you on Instagram at, am I getting this right? Wasp Archer.
Yeah, that's it.
Where'd that come from?
I'm a bow hunter. It used to be a broadhead I use, and I've just never changed it. And
got it.
But yeah, and then of course you can. I also have a children's book you can see behind my shoulder here, "Immigrant American Survivor to Inspire Children." It just basically tells my story as how I came from Colombia, what I grew up with, you know, what every kid grows up with, bullying and all that, how to survive that, how I survived it, and goes into the events of 9/11, which teaches them, and at the end it shows them that you can attain your dreams no matter what. So both books are on Amazon.com. Just look up Will and then J-I-M-E-N-O. And if you do, I hope you share it with a child, the children's book. Mm-hmm. And the other one, I hope you share for yourself if you need it, or a loved one who's suffering with PTSD. And they also have it in audio, the adult book. So if it's a person that doesn't want to read, they can at least listen to it and hear the same story and hopefully help them.
Excellent. I found you on Facebook at Will Jimeno. And again, it's J-I-M-E-N-O. And actually on Instagram, I typed in Will Jimeno and got you that way. So didn't see you on X, didn't see you on LinkedIn.
I'm still enjoying retirement. Like I said, I go on there and I try to put as much inspirational stuff as I can. Of course, good stuff with the family. But I think social media is a double-edged sword. I try to see from bad stuff. I try to see the good stuff where I see people having grandkids, people having their kids' communions, their graduations. People always be the person that roots for people. Yeah. Don't be the person that puts people down. Uplift people. Be the person that claps for people. Don't be the person who sits there and doesn't clap. Be the person who claps for someone, even if it's someone you're not fond for. Be the bigger person. You'll be happier for it.
Absolutely. So again, the books are the big book is Sunrise Through the Darkness. I just go on Amazon. It's a survivor's account of learning to live again beyond 9/11 by Michael Motes and our guest here today, Will Jimeno. Then the Immigrant American Survivor, a little boy who grew up to be all three, the children's book, available on Amazon. Brother, just can't say thank you enough to be so open and honest. I hope this was therapeutic for you. I hope our listeners learned something. Look for signs of your friends and families that might be suffering from things that you don't know about. Offer up this book. Get help. Call 988 if you're having extremely bad thoughts. There's nothing in this world that you have to go through alone. There's always somebody out there to help you. So, Will, brother, thank you. I wish you all the best for you and your family. God bless. For our listeners, thank you for coming back every week. If you haven't checked us out on YouTube yet, do me a favor and go over. You can meet Will online there on the video portion. Type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar and hit that subscribe button for me. Love you guys. Appreciate you coming back next week or every week. But I know why you continue to come back. It's because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's the game of crimes. See you folks next week.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances. And get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.